Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor, producer, and author Rob Lowe. Rob Lowe is not a guy who messes around. At age 8, he decided he wanted to be an actor. And by age 11, he was making unsupervised 60-mile bus trips into Hollywood for auditions and voice lessons. He landed his first major movie at age 18, and by 26, he'd gone through a scandal and rehab, emerging sober with most of his career still ahead of him. So, what do you do for an encore? If you're Rob, you go on to do The West Wing and Parks and Recreation. You make some missteps with a couple of network shows, but also come up with The Grindr, one of the most clever and original shows we've seen in years. The more I learn about Rob and his career, the more I think he's probably one of our most underrated artists. And he's also a surprisingly talented writer who chronicles his life and career in two of the most honest and entertaining memoirs I've ever read. Fortunately, he's just as good of a storyteller in person. Rob joins me to talk about the insanity of his industry, how rehab improved his acting, and why his Comedy Central roast was the greatest night ever. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Rob.
Hey, good to see you.
So you and I have known each other a while, and we've worked together. And it's fascinating not only to watch your career and to go back over all the things you've done that I've been around for, because we're pretty close in age. So I remember all these things as moments in my own life. But what I really love about the whole story of watching you is how honest you are. And I don't think that came out until you started writing books. And I just wanted to ask you about that, because I think when you're an artist, it can be really hard to be honest.
And the other part of it is there's not really the proper vehicle to get honest. You know, I mean, you're going to do your 60 Minutes interview and do it, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, maybe in the old days, the Playboy interview.
Right.
I mean, as our culture changes, the platforms for people to have real conversations. I mean, you can't do a talk show now unless you're willing to do charades, put on a big red nose, and do an act. They have no interest.
Yeah.
So even those things are gone. So it took the books to for me to have a platform where I could talk about who I really am and what I'm really interested in, and also it's incumbent upon you as a memoirist to be honest, right? That's part of the genre. You better bring it, or there's no point in it.
That's right.
And then, you know, you're never really ready until you're ready, and so it all kind of came together for me to do it in the way I did it, and I'm really proud of both the books, really proud of them.
Did you have a couple false starts before you found your voice, or did you have any sort of a roadmap for the way you wanted it to? Because you're a good writer, you're good at setting a scene, and I wonder if you had any kind of trouble finding your voice at first in that format.
One of the reasons I wanted to do the book was I had, you know, as I write, I'll give talks around the country from time to time, and I obviously write my own speeches, or, you know, I would write screenplays, and I discovered I had a voice. And so I knew I had the voice before I did the books, and that's why I wanted to do it. I felt like I had something to offer. I had sort of discovered that over the years. And then the question was, like, what do they look like? And I loved David Niven's book, The Moon's a Balloon. It came out in the early 70s, David Niven being the great British character actor, and
yeah.
The book was a sensation. It sold tons of copies, was in print forever, because he was a great raconteur, and he had great stories. And I have stories in my own life, and I wanted it to be the modern version of that, because you don't see it. Because what you get now when celebrities write books, a lot of it are sort of mea culpas or
advice.
They're straight advice books. The Niven books were dishy in the just the right way. It's like, you know, he name dropped and took you behind the scenes, but in a way where nobody got hurt.
Right.
And it didn't feel like
you were trading on that at the other people's expense.
Yes, yes. And then the other thing is, I didn't want any, like, Andre Agassi wrote a great book.
Yeah.
Open. And that was very inspirational to me. But one of the things he talked about, some of his drug use in it, and that was all anybody took out of that book.
Right.
So one of the little tricks I did in mine was in some of the more, headline grabbing material, I made sure I didn't write anything that you could take one or two sentences out and requote it.
Well, what you're talking about is not wanting to be reduced to a soundbite.
Right.
Which is the exact reason you're writing the book in the first place.
Exactly.
So when you were sitting down to do this, who were you writing to? Like, did you have a person in mind?
You know, it's funny. I would go out to dinner with people and who maybe hadn't met me. And inevitably, they were like, God, it was so interesting. That was so interesting. People were always surprised at who I really was, which blew my mind because I've been famous since I'm 15.
Right.
So over years and years and years of people going, wow, you're not like I thought that means something. There's an opportunity here. And the other thing is I was very vigilant, I think, about having it be entertaining.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that gets back to me a lot is people say, I read it in like a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, that's what you want. I wanted it to be a book you didn't want to put down and a book that flew.
Right.
I was very disciplined about what I wrote and what I didn't write about in terms of flow and pace. And to me, it was like making an album. I mean, I'll never be a rock star. God darn it. And, you know, the days when the orders of the songs meant something.
Yeah.
That's the way I looked at the book. It's like, geez, I have a bunch of ballads, but I don't have anything up-tempo. And then, I have five up-tempo stories. And I need, so that's exactly the way I looked at it, particularly the second book.
That is so interesting, because the second book does do that. I mean, there's a ballad pretty near the beginning when you talk about taking your son off to college,
yeah,
right? And that's the big power ballad.
And by the way, the power ballad was the single.
Yeah, that's right.
That was the single.
That's
right.
That
was the one that went viral. Every year, that chapter, as college falls start approaching, just gets shared and passed around and goes back on the internet, and it's an evergreen life of its own thing, and it's a great thing for storytellers to learn, because we know it, but we sometimes don't trust it. I almost didn't write it because I thought, what's the big deal sending my kid to college? Plenty of people do it. And
right.
I almost didn't write it.
The lesson there being, if it's so specific to your life, how is it going to relate? And it's exactly the opposite. It's the most relatable thing.
That's exactly right. And so I have all these big pyrotechnical pieces in it that are larger than life. And the one that has the resonance is the one that is the sort of most honest, detailed, smallest, most common experiential chapter of the book.
And what do you learn from that?
Well, it's one of the gifts of being a writer and a communicator, and however we do it, is we get to be reminded of each other's shared mutual humanity.
Right, right.
That we're all so much more alike than we are different.
There's a quote in that story where your son is about to go off into this crowd of students, and he has the experience that I had when I went off to college, and I think probably is so common, which is you look around at everybody and you go, oh no, they're all better than me. Mm-hmm. They all have it more figured out. And you say to him, don't judge your insides by someone else's outsides.
That's right.
And I couldn't help but stop and look at that and go, like, how resonant is that to you in your own life? Because you're someone who's been judged by your outsides since you were too young to figure out what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. Where did that quote come from?
That quote actually is a quote I learned in the fellowship of AA.
Oh, really?
And there are plenty of people that tell you that AA, it's all slogans and platitudes. I love the slogans and the platitudes. I can't get enough of them. And that's one of them. And that's been one of my favorite ones. I found it deeply profound when somebody said it to me. So I use it whatever chance I get. And because I find it to be so true. It was applicable for my son showing up at the Chapel of Duke for his first day of school and looking around at the best and the brightest and going, how the hell did I get in here? It can be me showing up on a set with working with maybe one of my heroes and going, oh my God, you know, whatever. We all have that in our lives.
Yeah.
And we don't know what's going on underneath the other person. We have no way of knowing that. So for us to compare our insides to their outsides, which is all we can see, is a folly.
Yeah, and that's one you have to keep learning, too. You have to keep telling your... Like, that's probably why slogans become slogans.
Because they work.
Well, talk about that a little bit, because there's these great lines that I drew through both books and into looking at your career of you talking about Chris Farley and how you discovered that the pretty boy and the fat boy had a lot in common.
Yeah.
talk about that a little bit, because it's the same thing where people maybe don't see you for all of who you are. They just see one thing.
Yeah, it's what I have learned over the years is, like, why when I was a teenager and just getting well known, and we get stopped on the street and girls would scream. And by the way, when I tell these stories to my kids, they all think it's bullshit. They think they're like, that didn't happen to you, Dad. I'm like, it did. I'm like, I was the guy. But like, why, what about that felt, it should have felt great. And part of it did, but there was always something underneath it that felt, ugh. And why? That's crazy talk. Who doesn't want that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it took me sort of years to sort of figure out what it is. And what it is some of it's being a fan, some of it's appreciating the work, but a lot of it is just flat out old-fashioned objectifying of someone.
Right, right.
It could be anyone. And by the way, that's why it isn't me today. It's somebody else. And that's why every year it's somebody else.
Right.
It'll be Justin Bieber for a while, and then it'll be the guy. So it'll be the guy from One Direction, and then it'll be. It's just somebody has got to be standing in that spotlight for people to objectify their own stuff onto them. They get into the spotlight because they have the goods to be on the radar.
Yeah.
But once they're in it, it almost isn't about anything about them. It's always about the person who's doing the objectifying.
Right, right.
And then that's what they want you to be. And you brought up the Farley thing, and you know, and they just wanted Farley to be fat and funny.
Right.
And Chris was more than that. Chris was a really good actor. He loved being fat and funny, and he was great at it, and we loved him for it. But, you know, I saw Chris struggle with people just wanting him to be that dopey, obnoxious, loud frat boy thing, and he was more than that. And people sort of objectify their own thing into it. So, I mean, it's sort of a lot of navel gazing about fame, but I do think it speaks a little bit to human nature and why it can be so uncomfortable for some people to stand in that spotlight.
Yeah, and plus, I think when I look at your career and when I read what you've written, I get this idea that you had a tremendous drive to be one of the heavyweights, to act with these people that were your heroes, because you loved acting. It wasn't like you were trying to be famous or trying to be hot or whatever it is.
Yeah, no.
And I would think as an artist, it would be incredibly frustrating, because I think now there's enough examples of kids where they do just want to be famous.
And I know this sounds insane, but I didn't even equate being famous to acting when I started.
Isn't that interesting?
Because I wanted to be an actor in Dayton, Ohio, and there was nobody famous there.
But there were actors.
But there were actors, yeah. And I never saw myself probably getting to the point where I could be famous. I just wanted to act because I connected to that, to telling stories in that way and inhabiting the characters and all the nuts and bolts that comes along with being an actor. And, you know, fame was never even a thought. And I do think that is reversed now.
In a way, maybe it's back to what you thought it was back then, whereas fame has nothing to do with acting.
That's right. Right. That's a good point.
But also, you know, I think you came up in a generation where kids were independent younger, and they got serious younger. And on one hand, I look at it and I go, okay, came from a product of divorce, so your dad wasn't around. Your mom was sort of in her own world when you were
very much so.
15, 16
very
years
much
old.
So.
There was no one driving you or pushing you.
No, it was me. I don't know what that comes from. I have tremendous work ethic and tremendous drive to this day and competitiveness in that way. I having have two sons of my own now, you learn that people just come into this world who they are. They really do. I came into the world that way. And the stuff that I was doing, I mean, I would like catch three different public buses, 60 miles one way to take voice lessons and then turn around and do my homework on the bus. First of all, today a parent would never let their kid do that.
Right, right.
You know, like, you're not getting on a bus in Malibu and taking it into the heart of Hollywood alone at 11. It's not happening. And that's what, I didn't think anything of it. You know, it was a different world, and it's what I wanted to do. And
did you feel like an adult
when you were that? When
yeah,
you were
I did. I did not feel like I fit in with the other kids.
You didn't?
Never.
See, I find that so interesting that...
I liked them. I had fun.
Yeah.
And I had friends. But I always felt a little bit like I was outside that circle because I knew what I wanted to do. That's a rarity. It's a blessing and a curse. I mean, you know, you don't they're trying to find themselves. You don't relate. You know what you want to do. You're all about it.
You know, you describe acting as a calling to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people, I think, find what they like to do and they get good at it. But they don't know that young.
Yeah, I knew at 8.
Talk about what is that little extra thing.
I don't know. I just finished the Bruce Springsteen book. I'm a huge Bruce fan, always have been. Feel like I know all of the, I've seen, I mean, what could I possibly learn from a Springsteen book? And I was blown away at it for a number of reasons. But one of them was I so related to his story of being misunderstood, not fitting in. It's not an I'll show them thing because it doesn't have that kind of negative connotation around it. But it's a little bit of like, I'm more than this. I know I'm more than this. And I will be more than this. And I will go to the ends of the fucking earth. And I will be the last man standing. You know, I look at the guys that I came up with. A lot of them are maybe more talented than I am. But I don't think anybody can match me on vision and the ability to execute it, right? And I really related to that in that Bruce book, and because I felt the same way.
You talk about Malibu being a place where a lot of kids, I mean,
it was a time
died on the beach or drowned or drugs.
A lot of death. I mean, in my junior high school, in that era, from 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, there were at least 10 or 12 kids who died. Now, today, that would be a national news storyline.
Yeah.
The deaths of Malibu. And it was just sort of, whatever. It was a very weird time. And then underneath it, we had all these actors coming up, which is, people are obsessed with it. I get it. It's interesting. But it does happen.
Did it feel like there were no parents?
It felt like there were no adults. It was like Lord of the Flies.
Right.
And, you know, maybe it was the dads were at work and the moms were checked out or whatever. But there was no feel of parental oversight.
You know,
it's
amazing to me that now, you know, obviously we have the opposite. We have helicopter parents that are in their kids' business 24/7. And I think all the parents are afraid that their child won't find the thing.
I know.
That keeps them away from the bad influences. And you never had that. In a way, you being so ambitious probably saved you from...
There's no doubt. My best friend in Ohio... I had two brothers in Ohio. One of them went to prison. One of them went to prison and then died in a police chase. Those were my best friends in Ohio. I'm not saying that would have happened to me, but we all know that for an adolescent to have, you know, something that they're really, really interested in is a lifesaver.
Yeah, for sure. And now I'm just curious about that idea of being an adult in a kid's body. And how it relates to when you know what you want to do.
By the way, now I'm a kid in an adult's body.
Which is the way to be, right? Maybe the trick is to just be the opposite of everybody else all the time.
Yeah.
How much time did you actually spend in high school?
I loved school.
You did?
I loved it. I loved learning. I did, which also made me different than everybody else. I went to public schools and they shit all over anybody who dared to want to sit in class and learn.
So you fought that, too.
Yeah, I was a pleasure to have in class. I sat in the front row, raised my hand, was really into it. I wasn't smart in certain things. I was horrible in math. Still am. But like, I liked school. I liked it. And that does not go over well with the cool crowd.
Especially then.
So then when I got to the big public high school, Santa Monica High School.
Because back then there was not a high school in Malibu.
No, we had to drive. We had to take the bus 22 miles one way to high school every day.
Isn't that wild?
It's just crazy. And I got The Outsiders, my first movie, at the midway through my senior year of high school. And they wouldn't let me graduate. They wouldn't give me the credits to do. They were not helpful to me, sort of accessing my dream. And so I never did graduate from Santa Monica High School. I took a GED to get my
I bet we could march you down there and get an honorary diploma at this point.
Yeah, right?
You would think.
I think maybe now. Well, they wanted me to be in their Hall of Fame recently, and I was like, you guys weren't so nice to me when I was trying to start.
Yeah. Does your Hall of Fame include an apology?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I find that part of the story interesting because you talk in the book about actually quitting. Like, there's a point where you say in your book that you applied to USC and UCLA.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was a six-month period or whatever. I know when you're that age, yeah, that seems like forever.
It does.
But you weren't getting work.
I wasn't getting work at all.
And you decided you were going to quit acting.
I was going to quit. I was going to be a marine biologist, maybe go to law school. And I met with a casting director on yet another project I didn't get. And I said I was probably going to quit. And she said, do me a favor, wait until you're 18. Wait until your 18th birthday. Because what's happening is we're hiring kids 18 and 19 to play younger because of the labor laws.
Right. So you just weren't getting work because of your age. You were, again, the adult in the child's body who needed to be able to work a full day.
Yeah, that's exactly what. And then sure enough, on my 18th birthday, I got The Outsiders. And
isn't that wild?
Never stopped.
God, well, it's crazy to think, you know, for someone who felt like this was your calling, to get to a point where you call your agents and you say, I'm done with this.
I'm done.
Like, it's like you had a whole life before you turned 18.
I did. That's still what it feels like as I look back.
Yeah.
I had a whole career of ups and downs and network deals and holding deals and pilots that didn't go and series that were on the air and movies I read for and all of it before I was 17.
I wonder about that idea of when you become, like, after The Outsiders, and obviously you're competing with all the guys that became the guys. I mean, in The Outsiders alone, that was a murderer's row of the next 10 years of film talent and beyond.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tom Cruise and Patrick Swayze and Matt Dillon and
then the people Thomas who didn't Howell. Get it, who weren't in it, that were in the auditions and screen
right,
tests.
Mickey Rourke and...
Yeah.
So around that time, did you notice a difference in terms of the way, like, I guess I'm wondering if there was ever a time where you clocked, oh, I'm sort of in this box of, I look a certain way, I'm being judged a certain way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I had the good fortune to be around and to come up at a time where the business was beginning to move to just a total glorification of youth.
Right.
I was very lucky in that way, but I was unlucky in the way that what people were really looking for in their leading men at the time was not traditional. So if I'd have come up in the 50s and 60s, I would have been exactly the matinee idol leading man everybody was looking for.
Right.
But I was coming up in, you know, in the post Brando, post, you know, Dustin Hoffman, Al Pacino.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually really didn't fit the mold of what movies wanted their leads to be. They wanted sort of early Nick Cage, Matthew Modine.
Troubled, a little bit.
New York-y.
Darker New York.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, you can't force people to put you in something that they don't see you for. So
right.
I'm not going to get the movie Ordinary People.
Right.
This isn't happening. I'm not going to get that Sidney Lumet movie, or I'm not going to get, you know, that Alan Parker movie Birdie. Like, that's not happening. So only later in my career did I get to that place where I could do a movie like Behind the Candelabra.
Right, right.
Like, there was no Behind the Candelabra for me when I was 19, 20, 21, 22,
no.
23. That just was not going to happen.
Did that bother you, or did it frustrate you?
Yeah.
It did?
Oh, yeah. It was brutal.
Did it feel sometimes like certain opportunities are passing you by and you have all the chops to get those things and you're just not seen for them?
Yeah, no, that's part of the gig, you know, that is part of the world of an actor.
Right.
You know, I mean, and how you come to terms with it and how you make your peace with it says as much about your sustainability as anything.
Well, speaking of Behind the Candelabra, one of the things that I think is interesting is that idea that when you get a role, oftentimes the producer's expecting you to come in and be Rob Lowe.
People want a certain thing. I've had, listen, I can tell you so many horror stories. I've done movies where I played real actual people, and I'll be like, okay, so I got to get my contact lenses. Like, oh, no, you can't wear contact lenses. I said, why blue eyes? The character had brown eyes.
And you're playing that real person.
Yeah, and I'm playing a real person. But we paid for the Rob Lowe blue eyes. But I'm playing a real, you can Google the person and see.
Yeah.
Don't care.
That must be crazy. So in your book, Love Life, you say, I like playing depraved characters. And, you know, you enjoyed the process of pulling your eyes back and behind the candelabra. You enjoy turning your hair gray.
I'm making up for lost time.
Right. And I just wonder if that is exactly what that is, if it's nice to escape that image for a while.
It's freeing, you know. There's something, you know, I really believe I'm a character actor trapped in a leading man's body.
You do?
Yeah, I really do.
I can see that. It would be such a great holiday from those kinds of expectations when you do something for Soderbergh and you get to play Dr. Starts and you get to take it to that level, because I would imagine that it could be tough to get excited about work when you have the contact conversation.
It's true. It's also why I've always liked whenever I've hosted Saturday Night Live or done any of those comedies. It's the same thing. Those are character parts. Like, you know,
right.
when I look at the SNLs that I've done, I like to feel like I was a primetime player. I'm not the star coming in for that week. I'm like one of them. If you look at the sketches.
And
part of it, I think, is just because I like ensemble work. And I think I like ensemble work because that was the first movie I ever did, was Outsiders, and it was ensemble. And then there's St. Elmo's Fire, ensemble, About Last Night, ensemble, West Wing, ensemble. I mean, you kind of go down the, I don't know why that is, but maybe other people inspire me, but.
Well, you and I are of the age where Saturday Night Live, we watch the original cast. Yeah. And that probably changed so many people's path or their idea of just from watching that troupe and how much fun they had and how different it was and subversive. And
yeah, I learned everything. I honed my comic taste on what's funny on Saturday Night Live. You know, and it was the first time I did it. It was, I think, probably the best cast other than the original cast. And some would argue even better than the original. It was Farley and Spade and Sandler, Kevin Nealon, Mike Myers, Dennis Miller, Dana Carvey.
Yeah, what a cast.
I mean, it's crazy. Chris Rock.
Now, were you going into that? Were you intimidated?
Oh, petrified.
Were you really?
Petrified.
Can you still like recall that feeling of?
Oh, but it's also so great. It's so, I mean, you know, my first thing I ever did was a cold open with Lorne. I'm like, I'm doing a cold open with Lorne Michaels.
The cold open?
I was worried that I was going to bomb, and it was Lorne coming in to give me a pep talk.
Okay.
That I wasn't going to bomb, and then I come out, and then I do the monologue, and I bomb. That was the joke.
I wonder if that was written because there was some anticipation. Like, obviously, comedy, best comedy is close to the truth. And
oh, for sure. Yeah, no, it was just, there's nothing like doing that live. I just did a roast on Comedy Central.
Yes, you did. I watched that.
And I will tell you, that was as close to doing Saturday Night Live as I've seen in a long time because the stakes are so high. It's live to tape. There's nowhere to hide. Everything's pointed at you. You have to be able to take it, suck it up, be a champ, and then turn around and destroy people.
Yeah.
And that's, it felt very much like Saturday Night Live on steroids.
Although you had a secret weapon. You had Ann Coulter, who people wanted to destroy more than they wanted to destroy you.
I know. I got very lucky there.
Yes, you did. Now, I want to know why put yourself into that roast situation.
Two reasons. I first of all, I love those roasts.
You love watching them.
Love them.
Yeah.
Love them.
It's the weirdest sport of all entertainment.
It is a sport. So the thing you said, sport, because that's what I feel like it is. It's like being in the NFL. It's like the harder they hit you, it's a badge of honor.
Right.
Like no one's hitting the punter.
Right.
But if you're Ben Roethlisberger, they're looking to clean your fucking clock out.
So that's interesting that you saw it almost as a competition.
Absolutely. And then it's a competition of they get to pound you. Guess what? At the end, I'm going to be pounding you in ways you haven't even dreamed of. So I knew what kind of jokes I had for people, and they were mean. So the first time I got hit, I was like, great. Because I knew the only way my stuff would be funny was if I got hammered.
Right. If everyone threw you softballs and then you came up and were terrible to everyone. But again, the impulse of putting yourself in that arena, to lay yourself that bare in front of an audience and not know, I mean, you don't know what they're going to say.
No, I don't.
Do you have any trepidation about that? Like, or at this point in your life?
I feel like it's at this point in my life, anybody who has Google can learn anything they want to learn about me, good and bad.
Right.
And I am who I am. I stopped auditioning a long time ago in all areas. And it is what it is.
In all areas. What do you mean by that?
It's like both auditioning for roles and auditioning in life for people.
You are who you are.
Yeah. Like it, love it, whatever. This is it.
Yeah.
This is what I got.
It's a different, I mean, it must be the most freeing thing of all though, right?
Very freeing. And fun. It's like it's the high wire. Like you go up there, that's not necessarily a great idea. Like you're saying.
No, I was like, why
would he do it?
I mean, I enjoyed it
Which
tremendously.
Which is, by the way, usually why I do something. Like if I can't figure out a good reason to do it, I usually end up doing it.
Did your wife think it was a good idea?
Well, I go to my kids who are very cool and smart and know everything comedy. And they're like, oh, Dad, you have to do it.
Oh, really?
They're like, oh, you have to. And then I went to my wife. She goes, oh, my God, you can't do that. And I go, oh, hmm. She goes, do they pay you? I go, yeah. She goes, how much do they pay you? And I told her. She went, oh, you have to do that.
Your wife, it wasn't about morals.
No, she's totally
just
mercenary.
About the check.
She's like, they should roast you every month for that.
Yeah, let's have a roast in our house.
So I got it covered both ways.
Well, it's testament to living your life in a way where, because I do think there's, for a creative artistic life, there is a period where I think everyone feels, how did I get here, or do I belong, or if they really find out about me, will they have me back?
Oh, for sure, that's part of the journey.
When did that disappear for you? Was that sobriety?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's because I think a lot of people have that. I don't think that's particular to just artists or famous
that's
people.
Fair.
It's probably exacerbated in our world, but the sense of I'm going to get found out is probably more general than the thing. And so for me, getting sober, that's one of the things you have to come to terms with to stay sober. I'm sober now 26 years. So that started the journey. And then I think getting sober and becoming a father really affected my work in a great way.
It did. How
yeah,
so?
I saw my work change for the better right around that time. And I think that was also helpful to own what I was doing.
Did it affect your decision-making process?
Totally. Like I didn't want to be doing movies all over the world. I wanted to be home. I'm so glad that as my kids are out of the house now that I made the choices I made, because I didn't miss a minute of it. I didn't miss a minute. And even not missing a minute of it, I'm still bummed. I can't even imagine what I would feel like if I had missed it while it was happening.
Right. If you're not sober, even if you were there, you wouldn't be there all the way.
Yeah. It's definitely the best thing I've ever done, for sure. Everything good that's ever come out of my life is, if you trace it back to the root, you trace it back to that decision.
What I'm really curious about is if there was a moment of overwhelming public shame that you had to deal with.
Yeah, listen, I mean, it's never a good day when you're personal shortcomings lead off the nightly news and Tiananmen Square is the second story.
Well, that's unusual circumstances.
Yeah, that's the truth of my life. That's something that happened for me.
But did it help you get to know you?
Only recovery did. Only getting into recovery and marching down that road that I stay on today. That did. Any of the public falling down that I've done or that anybody can do, that in and of itself, I didn't take as a learning experience. It was what I did about it afterwards that was tremendously illuminating. Remember, I'm a pleasure to have in class. We've established this.
So even in rehab, you were a pleasure.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
I loved it.
Really?
Loved it.
What did you love about it?
I mean, it was painful.
Yeah?
It was emotional. It was all those things. I loved it. I learned so much.
Had you done therapy before rehab?
Not really.
So it was almost like, oh gosh, someone cares about stuff other than my career and what.
Yeah.
You were being seen for the first time.
I'm being seen, not objectified, being seen. I mean, I was being seen. And that, I loved everything about it.
Right.
I really did. It was great. I mean, if I think rehab gets a bad name now. And by the way, there are a lot of bad rehabs.
Right. Sure. Like there's a lot of bad anything.
There's a lot of bad anything. But if you are in a place that's like for adults and really good and there's work to be done and you want to do the work, man, I can't think of a better gift to give yourself. Cannot think of it.
What do you think happened there that made it stick?
I was ready.
You were ready.
Yeah.
But you're so young. That's what's crazy.
26. But I'd lived. I mean, listen, I'd torn it up.
Right.
Right. And don't regret a minute of it. Any of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have great memories. It worked right up until the time it didn't work. And, you know, I do a lot of work with adolescents now in recovery. And the one thing I always tell them and the parents that come to me because they know that I'm interested and available to help is that it's never going to work if it's about making your parents happy or to keep a job or to hang on to a girlfriend or because you had a DUI. None of it works. It only works is if they're really done. Are they sick and tired? Are they done? Have they said uncle?
It's almost like...
I was ready. I was like, uncle.
Yeah, you had this compressed life where... You were working before anyone your age was working. You got serious before anyone got serious.
Yeah.
You went to rehab before anyone went to rehab. And it's almost like by the time you had gone through all phases of development, you were still so young. I mean that's probably the greatest gift is that you discovered yourself early.
It's an ongoing process.
Right.
I mean, I feel like every decade I have to give something up. I feel
really?
Like my 20s,
latest
drinking
thing?
And drugs, and then it's like, it's starting to become like food. It's starting to be like, dude, you can't wake up in the middle of the night
and have ice cream.
Get out of bed from asleep and then go hammer down the Haagen-Dazs. That's like not what people who are on network television every week do. Eventually, if I live long enough, I'm going to be up in some monastery, like a grain, and just like,
exactly. And you'll just have slogans.
Yeah.
That's
all I have left now.
Yeah, slogans and grains.
That's all I have left to look
forward to. Well, I find it very interesting that your career spans a couple eras that at the time seemed like they wouldn't change. Number one, movies were bigger than television and more important than television.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Number two, that network television was king and any kind of cable things were second tier. And I wanted to talk to you about that because I feel like because of your unique position in the, you know, like the West Wing started and was probably the model for the fact that a serialized television show could be so, it could have such in-depth characters and such great writing that it could be beloved the way it is.
Yeah.
And I think that show in a way started that trend of binge television.
For sure.
You
There's
know?
No well, and we know it started Netflix because The West Wing was one of the very first things that Netflix ever bought.
Oh, that's interesting.
That they streamed
that.
And it worked. Absolutely.
You even said, I think, that when you met Bill Clinton, that although he watched every movie that came out, you didn't think he actually watched The West Wing because...
Oh, he told me he didn't watch it.
So I find that fascinating.
But everybody in that West Wing watched it. And he was very interesting. I like him very much. And he was very coy about it. There was something about, I don't know if it was that he couldn't give it up to say that by the way, fast forwarding now in WikiLeaks, my favorite thing about the WikiLeaks is that it came out that Hillary was interested in finding out when The Good Wife aired and when Parks and Rec was on.
There you go.
So thank you, Julian Assange.
WikiLeaks can do some good
right?
for ratings.
Yeah. So the Clintons have always been fans of the stuff I've been on, as it turns out.
Well, what I took from that story was that it used to be really hard to watch network television because you had to be home when it was on.
Totally.
And you straddle this era where now TV is completely on demand and you've seen it shift. And one of the things that struck me about your story is the Nip Tuck example, which in a nutshell was that you watched Nip Tuck, loved it, went and took a meeting with Ryan Murphy and said, this show is great. I would love to be on a show like this. And he pulled his hair out and said, I wrote that for you and I couldn't get it to you because your agents wouldn't give it to you. So you were on the side of, I mean, really in a network golden cage because you were such a big network star that they weren't going to show you little cable pilots like Nip Tuck.
No, they weren't.
I mean, that's got to be one of the most frustrating things as an actor who wants to do interesting work is when the thing stopping you from it is your own agent thinking, like, I can't let him take a step down to do this.
And that's part of what's going on in our industry. I mean, that every new platform that comes up is unproven until it's proven.
Right.
Like Ryan Murphy said, I wasn't Ryan Murphy yet. He was the seventh staff writer off of Charmed. Look at it from my agent's perspective. They're not taking me from Aaron Sorkin to the seventh staff writer from Charmed to a network called FX that's never had a show on it before.
And yet, that's exactly what they should have done. In hindsight.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so it's a yin and a yang. To me, the thing about that, above and beyond being an interesting lesson in how Hollywood works, was that what he wrote for me spoke to me through the television week after week after week without me ever even knowing it was written for me.
Isn't that amazing? Well, you were so honest about your failings after The West Wing in terms of The Lion's Den and Dr. Vegas. And
those chapters in my book are some of my favorite chapters in the books. That's really what show business is like. That's what it's like. Like, everybody writes about what it's like to be in a hit. I think it was really interesting to write about what it's like to be in a show that's going down the toilet.
Right. And the fact that you can go from The West Wing and then be on a show with every good intention, great writers, everything is in place formulaically to make it work, and it doesn't.
It just doesn't.
And that shines a light on how little control an actor can have.
Yeah.
And you were even a producer on those shows.
Yeah.
But the idea that something can be fixed once it's already on the track, I think that was a very revealing thing to me.
You have to be very careful about buying in on the potential.
Right.
You know, like that's that old thing, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. So I don't say this in a grandiose way, I have vision. So I can look at something and I can see what it can be. I can see how it can be better. I can see how it can be improved. I can see how it can go in this direction. And just because I can see it doesn't mean the rest of the people involved with it can see it or want it. So in those two shows, I wanted to make one thing. They wanted to make another. We ended up making neither. And they were the shows that didn't work. That's why, you know, when you find yourself on a show where everybody's making the same show and seeing the same improvements and seeing the same shortcomings and agreeing on it, it's a miracle.
Yeah.
And it's great.
It's so rare, right, to have an ensemble group of creatives making something and have them all know that they're making the same thing.
I mean, I did a show once where I wanted to make, called Dr. Vegas, where I wanted to make it the network version of Nip Tuck. I was trying to, like, make up for lost time. And it would be weird and edgy, and my partners wanted to make it soft and funny and sort of quasi-charming and no real stakes.
What I found sad about that chapter was not that there was one conversation like that where you said, I want it to be this, and they said, I want it to be this. You found yourself in that position where you're a producer, but you're also acting, and it's sort of like, you know, they say that thing about a frog. If you put a frog in lukewarm water and turn it up to boiling, he'll never feel himself die because
it's
too incremental. And you were sort of handled through that process.
That's exactly what it is. That's how it all goes wrong. It's incremental, imperceptible, bad decisions that in and of themselves alone, all right, whatever. But in their totality, turn up the boil and you end up being the frog.
Right. Exactly. And I think, you know, coming from a show like The West Wing, where you are probably in a situation where everyone is on the same page creatively, and maybe more so than anything else, there's a really strong voice that isn't going to compromise.
Yeah. I mean,
how rare is that?
Oh, my God. Aaron Sorkin would, if he wrote the motorcade pulls up to the harbor and 10 battleships are anchored, we'd show up at the harbor and there'd be 10 battleships, not six, not five, not three, 10. It just doesn't happen anymore.
To have that as your palette setter for your television
career. That was my
first
TV series. It's like going to the Super Bowl in your rookie year.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, well.
This is just what I'm going to do every year.
We got so jaded that they got to the point where we didn't know if we were like, are you going to go to the Emmys this year? I don't know. The last time the West Wing won Best Show, I didn't even go up on the stage.
You didn't?
No. I was already working on Liza. Amazing.
Yeah. And you just assume when you do that, especially it being your first situation, you would assume like, oh, now I know how to do television shows.
I can do this.
Did it blow you away when Lion's Den didn't succeed? Like, was it a shock to you?
Because it happened so imperceptibly that when the axe finally fell, it wasn't that shocking. But yeah, I was really surprised because the cast was great. Everybody on that show went on to great things immediately. Kyle Chandler went on to Friday Night Lights. David Krumholtz went on to Numbers. Elizabeth Mitchell went on to Lost. I mean, I can pick good actors and did. And you know what it was? It was the first year that the network television ratings dropped out of the bottom. It was the very, if you go back and look at it, it's the first year of the new normal.
Right.
And ironically, now what we were canceled for, you would give your eye teeth for. But that was the beginning.
In terms of rating numbers.
Yeah, it was the beginning of the slide. It was the beginning of cable. It was the beginning of HBO. It was the beginning of Showtime. It was the beginning of all of that. And we were just sort of at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of a show that was just recently canceled, The Grinder, if people haven't seen this show, they should go on Netflix right now and watch all, 22 episodes of The Grinder, which it's sort of confusing, but you play an actor who was on a show called The Grinder. You were The Grinder for 8 seasons. Your beloved big TV emotion, tension, you know, that sort of big TV actor. And we come in on the show when you are you're trying to live a normal life and your brother's a lawyer and you think, well, maybe I'll try being a lawyer. I was a lawyer on TV. And that's how it sets up. But the thing that show did brilliantly that I loved is that it lampooned television so well.
I love The Grinder. I mean, it's one of the highlights of my career.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I'm most proud of. I'm so grateful that we live in an era where a canceled show that's good can still live forever.
Right. The very fact that we're talking about it and people can right now go and just watch it.
I get more conversation and attention from it now from Netflix, where it is, than I did when it was on the air.
Does it feel like a cable show to you or a streaming show to you more?
It should have. I mean, listen, I give Fox a ton of credit. No other network would have ever even put it on. They would have been like,
Why?
Because I was playing an actor.
And what is the stigma against playing an actor?
Well, and by the way, maybe they're right, because it didn't get the audience it should have. And their thing is, America writ large doesn't give a shit about show business or actors. And they may very well be right. So any other network would have said, oh my God, this is the funniest script we've read in 10 years. You're perfect for this. Could he be an accountant?
It's so funny.
For sure. Without a doubt, they would.
So funny.
And Fox, to their credit, was like, no. Obviously, he has to be an actor. We have no show. They put it on, and you know, it didn't do the kind of numbers that we would have hoped. But that is the other thing, is there's this sort of double standard out there that's tough, because you have all these amazing shows, but you don't know how many people are watching them.
No, we have no idea.
So the network shows are still, like the Grinder should have been a streaming show.
Right.
It should have been, and it is. But people who haven't seen it are going to, I mean, I love it. It's
well, you sort of get to have your cake and eat it too with that show, because you get these big network television acting moments, and then you get to completely make fun of them.
Yes,
and you get to
totally.
I would think that some of those things that happen on the show are pretty close to real life.
There's an episode that we do about audience test screenings. That is my favorite half hour of comedy, certainly that I've ever been a part of. My character goes in, they're screening an episode of The Grinder, and he says to the woman running the focus group, so these people, they're experts in, she goes, oh, nothing. Oh, they know nothing. And it's how television is made. I mean, it legitimately is. I think that was, we were not only biting the hand that fed us, we were severing the hand that fed us when we made that episode.
Well, how do you go back? I mean, you're on Code Black now. How do you go back to a TV show that isn't sort of able to peek around and look at it from another angle?
Yeah, well, the first 2 episodes of Code Black, all I could think about was, what would the grinder version of this be? Well,
the funny thing, there is one moment in Code Black in the very first episode you're on where you whip your sunglasses off. And I think that's something that people have done without irony in TV shows
since the beginning of time.
And yet, I can't watch that scene without thinking of the grinder.
The grinder, I know. And the reason I did it on the grinder was just my homage to, of course, David Caruso.
Right.
Now, the supercut on YouTube of David Caruso taking his sunglasses off may be the greatest piece of entertainment that's ever been created.
Right.
It's the greatest thing I've ever seen. So, you know, but that's the transition from comedy to drama. People talk about it a lot. What is it? How does it feel? That's the hard part, because my brain got hardwired into finding the comedy in places that other people don't. That's what makes good comedy, is finding it in surprising areas, right? So taking like a big network traditional show and then turning it on its head for comedy was what made the grinder fun and interesting. And then now I'm on Code Black, which is a traditional network drama.
For the first
2 weeks, all I could think about was how I could make it funny.
Is that true?
Yes.
So what does it say to you when something that's so smart and so that works so well, I mean, when you get sort of cut off from expanding that, that must have really hurt.
It did. It was like, look, we got a Golden Globe nomination. I got that for Best Actor for it. I mean, the critics loved it. But, you know, it's the network game. I don't pretend to understand it.
You've done it longer than anybody.
But again, I give them credit. They put it on and nobody else would have. It would have been this, oh my God, we love this, we can't do it.
Well, before we get off the grinder, I just want to say one more thing, which is I picked up on the fact that you didn't know Fred Savage before you guys started filming. And you talked about having instant chemistry. And I think that that's a word that bears a little bit of study, because chemistry is like this nebulous thing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you if that was something that you hold in high regard as an ingredient for success.
Oh, in the highest regard, because it's unknowable. I mean, if we could bottle chemistry, or if we knew what it was, every single thing would be a hit. And you can't manufacture it. It has nothing to do, by the way, with how much you like the person.
What do you think it is?
That's what's really weird. I happen to love Fred Savage. He's one of my favorite people. But what I've learned is I also have had tremendous chemistry with people I could not fucking stand.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Yes. Does that make you go,
maybe I'm missing something? We know that's true, because we know McCartney hated Lennon.
True.
I mean, we know that's true.
That's a great example.
It has nothing to do with how you get along. Nothing. I think chemistry is usually found in odd couples. Like where you go at first blush, you go, huh, as opposed to, oh yeah.
Right, like the ones that would make sense on paper don't make sense in the room.
Exactly.
Okay.
One other barrier to getting in is like you have this read, that read, then you have your chemistry read. But a lot of times in a finite, contained situation like a chemistry read, you can mistake a good scene for chemistry.
So the writing's really great and...
Yeah, you can kind of like, I thought it was good. It was really good, right? Yeah, right? I mean, like, right. But like when it's real chemistry, it's undeniable.
Yeah, it's such a thing, because you say if you could bottle it, that would be that's the secret.
It's the secret.
Well, before we finish, I wanted to ask you one more thing about the time you got an acting coach well into your career after being self-taught. To the point of On the Outsiders, where you gave up all of your emotion because you didn't even know that you weren't on the close-up.
Yeah.
And like, I imagine there must have been a moment early in that process when this whole vista opened up of what you didn't know.
For sure. I mean, what opened up first is the fear of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and like having somebody step on my natural gifts, right? That's the fear. That's what kept me from having an acting coach any earlier than that.
Like a great golf swing or something. Like,
yes,
question.
That's exactly it.
Well, so it took some courage to say, okay, I'll try this, right?
Yeah, and I was in, and it's funny. I was newly sober. I was in a sort of fuck it phase of my life. I was trying new things. I was getting rid of the old, turning over new leaves.
Well, what struck me is this idea of always finding a truth to the scene.
That's critical. So this acting coach says, I'm playing a deaf, you know, you can't speak, can't hear, right? in this great Stephen King book, The Stand, the character of Nick. And I go in with my ideas about how I'm going to, you know, prepare for it. You know, am I going to, I'm deaf in one ear anyway in my life, so maybe I'll wear something in this ear and I'll just see what it's like to really hear nothing and blah, 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 blah. And he kind of listens to me for a while and he goes, yes, or you could hear, because you do hear, you're playing the part, you do hear, and you can play that truth and figure out why you would lead people to believe that you're deaf. I was like, what? And he goes, well, he goes, I literally was like, wait, what? I wasn't even sure I knew what he was talking about. His point was, look, John Malkovich, I think, was nominated or won an Oscar for a movie called Places in the Heart where he played blind. And somebody asked him, how did he prepare? He said, no, I didn't really prepare. I just focused on the places in my life where I am blind.
Right.
So it's all about, his thing is, all of that is more artifice. It's already artifice. You're already saying things that aren't of your creation.
Right.
It's totally artificial. And so why would you put yet another layer of artifice on top of it? You can hear. Were you going to act like you don't hear on top of it?
But that must have blown your mind.
Blew my mind.
Like, yes, that's what acting
it
is.
It still blows my mind. Saying it now, it still blows my mind. And so we played it. So he says, I said, so let me get this straight. I'm going to go on this big miniseries playing a deaf mute, but I can hear. And what I'm playing is, I'm pretending to be a deaf mute. And he goes, yes. And I go, well, what did the director think? He goes, oh, he must never tell the director. So that's what I did, and it worked. It worked great. I don't know if I would do the same thing again today, but it's an amazing... He apparently also worked with... Remember the movie, the Tarantino movie? What's the first one?
Reservoir Dogs. Yeah.
Okay, so there's the dead... Remember they kill the guy and his body's like strapped to a chair?
For like a long scene.
Yeah. For like a long... So that was one of his clients.
The guy in the chair?
Yes. He's not dead.
So what's he doing?
He's playing... He's there being quiet, hoping he doesn't get found out.
Okay, so that's a mind-blowing meta conversation right there, that what he's doing is...
You brought it up. You started this.
He's playing dead. But he's playing dead to the people
in
the room.
No, you just said it. What is he doing? He's playing dead.
Yeah.
He's going, I hope these guys in this scene don't see me breathing. I didn't hold my breath really. Oh, I got to hold my breath a little bit better. That's what he's actually doing. Because guess what? That is what he's actually doing.
It's a beautiful example because it's like, well, you can't research dying.
Exactly. That was the one that I didn't put this part in the book. That was the other big example he gave me because that movie had just come out.
Huh.
And there were reviews that mentioned, I think his name is Kurt Baltz, that mentioned Kurt Baltz is effective as the dead body. His presence is felt in every frame, even though he is tied to a chair. And he's like, yeah, because he's not playing dead.
But he's playing dead.
But he's playing dead.
We're in the vortex now. Now that you've completely blown my mind.
Right?
Listen, you're born to be an actor, and who knew, but it turns out you're born to be a writer too, and it's fascinating. No, like, I hope you write more books.
I have an idea for a third one.
You do?
I do.
Good.
I do. I'm already taking notes. I'm already in the beginning processes of it.
And I hope you figure out a way to bring the grinder back.
Oh, it'll be great. I hope so too.
Or maybe the grinder could just show up every now and then in all your straight.
I want to do the actual grinder TV series, like where he's the bad, where he's the over the top.
Then
TV
you're not
lawyer.
Playing an actor; you're playing a lawyer.
Exactly.
Problem solved. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, that's our show today. Thanks for listening. And before we tell you about next week's guest, I just want to take a minute and thank you all for tuning in to Off Camera. We are having a great season, and with every one of these conversations I have, I feel like the luckiest person in the world because I get to sit in this chair and have these conversations with these amazing artists, and I learn something new every time we do it. And I hope you do too. And listen, if you have any comments, criticisms, suggestions, ideas, you just want to drop me a line and say hi, please do. My email address is sam@offcamera.com, and I would love to hear from you. And if you love the show, please don't keep it a secret. Tell all your friends about Off Camera so we can keep bringing you these conversations. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress Mackenzie Davis.
You want people to be game with you. You're asking the people that you're working with to like push you and to be more game than you are and to like commit to things at the same level you are or more. And if they're doing it more than you, you're like, oh fuck, I need to be at that level. It's one of the only spaces where it's not cool to opt out.
While she may be a bit of a late bloomer in Hollywood years, she's made up for it by quickly scoring roles in acclaimed projects like Breathe In, Always Shine, Halt and Catch Fire, and the upcoming Blade Runner. We'll talk about how she's used these projects as motivation and inspiration in an industry and a society that still clings to female stereotypes. It's a fascinating conversation. I'll see you next time, off camera.